Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly local news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, Ambassador John Huntsman Jr. announces his resignation. Federal lawmakers respond to the latest mass shootings in America. The mayoral primary in Salt Lake City enters the home stretch and more. And joining me for this conversation is Salt Lake Tribune Washington correspondent, Washington bureau chief, that is, Thomas Burr. And good morning and welcome to you, Thomas.
Good morning, Roger.
Also, reporter Taylor Stevens is here. And good morning to you, Taylor.
Good morning.
And then we've got George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. Good morning and welcome, George.
Good morning.
And on the phone, just for the very beginning of the show, is Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Hello and good morning to you, Jen.
Hi there.
The way to join this conversation, listeners, if you are inspired to do so, is to call 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And you can tweet questions and comments to us as well. Our handle is at KCPW. We are going to start very local today and then move outward from there. This coming Tuesday marks the end of the mayoral primary here in Salt Lake City. Then there will be two candidates. Before we turn to reporter Taylor Stevens for the latest in the mayor's race, Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce, this morning your paper published a story acknowledging some problems with a poll that had generated some reporting on this race. This was a Salt Lake Tribune Hinckley Institute of Politics poll conducted at the end of July. How did you learn that there was something wrong with the poll, and what kinds of problems are we talking about here, Jen?
Yeah, so we commissioned this poll, as you mentioned, with the Hinckley Institute. We crafted the questions. Hinckley took those questions to a call center, and they went out and did the survey. They came back with some data, and then we started reporting. And that's when some discrepancies started to become clear. We noticed my team of reporters, which is diligent and very detail-oriented, when they started making calls and digging further into the data, talking to people, we realized that the data was not as represented. This poll was supposed to be only for Salt Lake City registered voters, people who would actually vote in this election. And it turns out that some of the data was wrong. People who had recently moved for whatever reason, there were 57 of those errors. And so, I mean, thankfully my reporters were able to bring this to light. But, it's disappointing that we had done a number of stories relying on this reliable data that wasn't reliable.
You know, you said 57 of the people who were polled don't live in Salt Lake City as a result. That's of the 444 people surveyed. That's around 13% of respondents.
That's right.
How did Salt Lake Tribune and Hinckley hired a polling group called Cicero. How did Cicero end up calling some people who were not Salt Lake City residents?
Well, their explanation, and I believe them to be true, they got the voter records, the registration records from Salt Lake County. But what they failed to do is to get the most accurate list. So they used 2016 data. It's 2019. And the clerk's office routinely updates this. And of course they updated it when they sent out the recent batch of ballots to, 360-odd, whatever, 1,000 voters. It isn't fail-proof. They have received 12,000 of those ballots back. So, there is some wiggle room there. That is why a poll has a margin of error. But still, right. I mean, I think that the polling center fell short on this one.
They say, the Cicero says that the poll is still valid, that, after having rerun the numbers, it changes things just ever so slightly. Luz Escamilla, in their recalculation, gets one more percentage point. Are you comfortable that those results are reliable, Jen?
From the process that they went through, yes. I mean, I was very nervous to begin with, and that is why, we went through this exercise to make sure that what we reported to the public is actually true. As you mentioned, the margin of error went up slightly from 4.6% to 4.9%, and the percentages for candidates just barely wiggled. Luis Escamilla gained a point. I think Aaron Mendenhall gained a point. And the undecideds went down, which you would expect for people who actually live in the city that they're going to vote in. You would think that at this point in the election process, they would have decided. So that didn't surprise me that much. So to me, that shows that the numbers are valid. I will confess, though, whenever you have this kind of discrepancy emerge, it does sort of shake your confidence and make you think twice about the reliability of polling. Hmm.
Yeah, making any sort of error is a journalist's worst nightmare. And then, the code of ethics says you got to acknowledge your mistakes. And that's basically what you're doing in this instance. You're talking about the value of polling in general. Politics often gets treated like a horse race, and a lot of people want to vote for the candidate that they think is feasible. And so polling can have an impact on actual votes. Are you worried about that kind of damage having been done?
Again, I don't want to minimize this, but to keep it in perspective, the change is very, very tiny.
Okay.
So, the impact on the election, I would say that voters are very savvy. Yes, they follow a horse race, but they also take lots of other pieces of information, including our reporting, into the decision-making process. When they're trying to evaluate a candidate, they look at campaign literature. If they're really into being informed, they'll go to campaign websites. They'll look at news articles. They will also incorporate in-person, because there have been a lot of town halls and a lot of debates between these eight candidates. So I think it's definitely part of the mix. But again, it didn't materially alter the results that we reported previously. So I don't want to exaggerate.
And again, I'm going to say that the mark of real journalism is acknowledging when you've made a mistake.
That's right.
It's tough, but there it is. Jennifer Napier-Pierce, I know that you have to run. I wanted to thank you for making time to answer these questions this morning. Thanks for
I would encourage anybody who is concerned to reach out to me. I'd be happy to speak with them. But again, I just have to give kudos to the reporters who dug into this, and particularly our politics and government editor, Dan Harry. He did an excellent job of explaining what had happened. He talked to people and presented a lot of evidence, and I just think that we would not know this if it weren't for diligent reporters like Dan and the rest of the team.
And the article is Tribune Hinckley poll on Salt Lake City mayor's race included at least 57 people who don't live in the city. You can find that at sltrib.com. And again, Jennifer Napier-Pierce, editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks for joining us for the first part of the show this morning.
Thanks, Roger. Take care.
Take care. Before we go on, George Pyle, I didn't give you a chance to comment on polling and the like. Is there anything you want to add to this conversation about some errors in how, I guess, the poll was not designed but conducted for Salt Lake Tribune and Hinckley Institute?
Well, I think journalists and people who follow politics have always had kind of a love-hate relationship with polls. I mean, we say we're not sure how accurate they are. We're not sure that it's just, the horse race and it doesn't really reflect what government might do if this person is elected versus if that person is elected. Now, for that, the Tribune has on its website, a table of questions, the same questions asked of all the candidates, the important questions about air quality and homelessness and all those things, where, and this is, there are no statistical errors in this. These are accurate representations of what the candidates say about each issue. So that's a good place to go look. As Jennifer said, the candidates' own websites are good places to look. The coverage through the campaign, the town halls, the debates that they've had, that's where you get the information about who you might want to vote for. In a primary where you had, eight candidates, and only the top two go through, if the poll turned out to be way off, now they've run the numbers again, they're removing the people who don't live in Salt Lake City, the numbers basically are the same as they were before. If we had determined that the numbers were way off, these numbers were way off, then you kind of are looking at a thing where, if I could vote for anybody, I'd vote for this guy, but he's like sixth in the poll, so I'd be throwing my vote away. So I got to choose from among the top three, even though they're not my favorites. The candidate at number five is, and he's, but I'm not going to vote for him because he's not going
to
win.
To me, that's such a frustrating part of the way a voter might make a decision. But there, I mean, there it is.
Well, and you know, the National Democrats are going through this with the electability question, and it's the same kind of thing. So the polls are interesting. The polls give you an idea as to whose message is resonating, but you shouldn't base your vote based on that, whether the poll is absolutely a slam dunk accurate or not.
We hadn't exactly planned on talking about this topic about polls today, but let's actually now turn to the topic of the mayoral race. And reporter Taylor Stevens is here in studio with us. And you reported this week on fundraising in this race. The mayoral primary has been pretty expensive in terms of the money spent by the candidates. Let's start there, and then we'll move on to the fundraising side of this, actually. How much money has been spent, Taylor Stevens?
Yeah, so the eight candidates in the race have spent a cumulative $1.1 million so far. They've raised nearly $1.5 million collectively. So that is shaping up to be one of the most expensive primary races in Salt Lake City history. That's partly due because there are so many candidates.
Right.
With eight candidates, there's obviously more money in play. But yeah, it's been an expensive race. A lot of candidates putting a lot of money into their ground game, flyers, mailers, et cetera, et cetera. So
advertising, I'm sure.
Exactly.
You see a lot of it online. There's billboards out there.
There's billboards. There's radio.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's any TV.
I have not noticed either. An expensive race, and again, as you said, in part because of the number of candidates jockeying for position. You reported that there's a lot of outside money in this race, coming from outside of Utah, that is. Where is that money coming from, and who is it going to, Taylor?
Yeah, so the Tribune, and so I did an analysis this week of how much money, as you said, has been coming from out-of-state sources. And it's kind of interesting. We found that there was nearly $200,000 in out-of-state cash, and that businessman and entrepreneur David Ibarra has kind of the biggest share of that. He's raised more than $126,000 of his $433,000 approximately. Which is about a third, 32% total. And that's interesting because, you know, in congressional races or sometimes in state races, you will see some outside forces kind of interested in the outcomes of a particular candidate, even if you are not within that candidate's jurisdiction or in their constituency. However, in a municipal race, typically you don't see big outside money flowing in, and so spoke with a political scientist who said that those numbers are a lot higher than would be expected. The second highest candidate was David Garbett. He raised 16% of his money out of state, but all the other candidates were below 10%, which is more typical, I would say.
You mentioned, for Ibarra, who's almost a third of his funding coming from outside of Utah, some of it was from politicians. This is in your reporting, from politicians outside of the state of Utah. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so Ibarra, as I said, he's a businessman. He owns, I believe, seven businesses, some of them nationally and some of them internationally in Latin America. And he is kind of has a wide network across the country, also through his brother's foundation, the Latino Leaders Network. And so he has received a lot of donations from politicians out of the state. And that was kind of what piqued my interest in this initially, you know, as you're going through the expenditures and you see so-and-so for Harris County and wonder, where's Harris County? Google that. California, you see some people from Denver, some people from Texas. So it's just kind of an interesting phenomenon. And David Ibarra says, you know, that would kind of reflect in a way his approach to the job. He says, I have this wide network of mayors and politicians and people I know, and, you know, they've solved some of the problems Salt Lake City's facing. I would turn to them for answers on homelessness, for example, or air quality to see, you know, what other municipalities have to offer. So,
and then you mentioned Garbett, David Garbett, the next highest with out-of-state contributions, 16%. Again, where is that money coming from?
Yeah, Garbett went to school out-of-state. He went to Harvard and Stanford. And he also has some family from out-of-state, he said, and that's kind of where his money is coming from. And that's not immediately apparent from the expenditures because it's not like they're coming from particular counties or, you know what I mean, but 16% for him. And I think there's always, you know, some It's worth noting that that's not necessarily, it's not illegal, it's not necessarily suspect, just interesting in the race, but there are concerns sometimes among people when there's outside money is, you know, what do these outside people want? Mm. You know, what kind of stake do they have in this race?
All right, and candidates, again, pointing to connections elsewhere, family and business associates and so on. George Pyle, is this a big deal? What do you think?
I don't think it's a big deal. I think it's appropriate that this all be made public and voters can take a look and make up their own minds. You worry about when you have a lot of money from anywhere, more so in a congressional race where there's more of it, that comes from PACs or corporations or something, because you have to wonder, if a politician gets elected, who is he beholden to? Is he beholden to his constituents who voted for him and might vote for him next time? Or is he beholden to the people who gave him money so he could get this job? In these particular cases, it does seem more like it's friends and contacts and family who just want to be supportive of their friend. It doesn't look like somebody's being bought, but it's important that this information be out there so voters can choose.
Okay. Just before we head to a break in the show, let's squeeze in one more story that you, Taylor, wrote about the mayor's race, and this has to do with some criticism some of these mayoral candidates had for one of their fellows, candidates taking aim at David Garbett, who we were just talking about, for one of his proposals. Tell us the story, Taylor.
Yeah, so David Garbett, one, you know, he says that air quality is his top priority, and he is a former Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance staff attorney, so this is an issue that's really important to him. He has been looking into or kind of proposing, what if we moved the refinery on the northern border of the city and the power plant near the Fair Park? What if we moved those, relocated them outside of the city, offered some incentives for those businesses to do that? In an effort to clean the air. And so his other candidates who, you know, everybody in this race, most everybody cares about air quality, says that it's an important topic to them. Rainer Huck, a candidate, says that he thinks this is a distraction issue from other big topics. But, you know, but they say everybody cares about air quality, but we have to be realistic. And this just isn't a realistic promise to voters. This isn't something that you can achieve. The state says it's something that they can't achieve. And Garbett, you know, he concedes that the businesses would have to make this choice on their own, that they would need to decide to move. But yeah, his opponents had some strong words for him. Erin Mendenhall said that she thought it was an exploitation of residents' legitimate concerns about air quality. David Ibarra called it desperate, ridiculous, and sensationalized. And they're saying, you know, he's just saying this to gain votes. He can't really do this.
That it's some sort of... How does David Garbett respond to those accusations?
He says, you know, we need a bold vision for how we're going to improve air quality, and we need to have big ideas, and we should have these conversations. And he says, you know, I'm not promising voters that I can do this. I'm just kind of want to start the conversation, because if we don't start this conversation, it will never happen.
Okay, so big ideas. I mean, other cities around the globe have done this with what they say are benefits. Mexico City moved refineries outside of the city, or at least one refinery outside of the city, and say that cleaned up their air. George Pyle, is this, you know, the other candidates seem to be saying this isn't feasible, so the fact that you're suggesting it is maybe manipulative. I don't know.
Yeah, I think, well, yeah, he's thrown this idea out there, and he said when you question him that, well, maybe it isn't actually possible, but it's the kind of thing you need to be thinking about if you're really going to attack this problem. And the problem is, it comes from many sources, and, you know, tailpipes are most of it. But, you know, people would like, I think to feel whether it's true or not, and there is some truth to it here, that there is one big evil player, and if we could just get rid of them, we would be so much better off, and then maybe each of us in our individual lives wouldn't have to feel so guilty about the pollution that's coming out of our tailpipes and the fact that we won't take the bus and we won't walk and we idle our cars all the time. You know, we would be excused for that because there's this evil presence over here that's the real problem, you could do things like you could exercise eminent domain, you could condemn the property, but you'd have to pay them for it, and that would be, you know, billions, and so we're not going to do that.
Oh, yeah.
You could impose regulations that that the refineries would say, that's too expensive. We're not going to follow those regulations. And if they stood up in court, which they might not, then they would say, okay, screw it, we're out of here. But that's not very likely either.
Again, we're talking about one refinery in Salt Lake City, aren't there? There are multiple refineries just outside of the
boundary. Right, they're not in the city anyway. So.
Okay. Well,
and I should note just really quickly that not all of the opponents are, you know, criticizing this. Stan Penfold, a former Salt Lake City councilman, said he thinks that this is a good long-term vision, although he would like to see more detailed numbers on what it would actually take financially for the companies to accomplish this.
Okay. You know, one sort of facet of a really interesting mayor's race that, again, we're going to see narrowed to a field of two just on Tuesday. Well, whether or not we know on Tuesday, the vote happens on Tuesday, right?
The vote happens on Tuesday. We could be in for a long week depending on how the votes come in. So stay tuned. We'll be following the updates.
Yeah, it's kind of this quaint idea that we have this thing called Election Day anymore. With all these mail ballot, it doesn't work quite that way.
All right. Well, get out and vote, and keep listening, and we'll bring you an update next Friday, I guess. We're going to take a quick break and then turn to some more Utah news. Next up, the response from our congressional delegation to the latest mass shootings in America. This is Behind the Headlines. Stay with us.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio. Support for UPR programming is brought to you in part by our members and the Cache Valley Visitors Bureau, featuring community concerts in Logan's Tabernacle Monday to Friday, and celebrating 52 years at the Kane Lyric Theater and 27 years at Utah Festival Opera and Musical Theater. More information available online at explorelogan.com.
How should the American legal system cope with a new era of hate speech?
In Europe, they've never had this problem. Neo-Nazis marching in Skokie? We would march them straight to jail.
Let them peddle their nonsense and then be subject to debate and criticism.
Thane Rosenbaum and Nadine Strossen join me in conversation on the next Intelligence Squared U.S.
Join us Saturday afternoon at 3 on Utah Public Radio.
And that's also coming up this morning at 10 o'clock.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, reporter Taylor Stevens, and columnist George Pyle. You can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255 or tweet to @KCPW. We don't really need the recap. Back-to-back mass shootings, one in El Paso, Texas, one in Dayton, Ohio. The culprits apparently each angry young white men. Familiar calls for action, maybe louder this time, and then there's the frustration and disgust that one of these men echoed sentiments of the President of the United States, who had talked about an immigrant invasion. And so people turn to their political leaders for action, for policy changes, for some sign that they're taking the problem seriously. And Thomas Burr in Washington, what was the response of our federal lawmakers to these latest shootings and calls for action?
A lot of thoughts and prayers. That seems to be the thing that we just take out of the boilerplate every time there's mass shooting in America. The Utah delegation, for the most part, Ben McAdams, the one Democrat Utah has in Congress, said there needs to be action, that it's about time that the Senate takes up measures to expand the background checks for people purchasing guns. Mitt Romney and Chris Stewart, I think John Curtis signed on this, the idea of red flag laws, that we need to pass legislation that allows somebody who's concerned, say I see somebody or I have a son or something like that that I'm really worried about, that you can go to the police and they can take away the guns for a little bit of time to let them see some, take care of some mental health issues. At the moment, what we're seeing nationally, though, is a lot of talk. The Senate is not scheduled to come back into session until, I think, September 9, at which point they say they will take up gun legislation. But it's probably not going to be the House passed measure, which expanded background checks for every gun purchase and more severely restricts things like assault-like rifles.
And that's just not something that the Senate is willing to take up, I guess. There is that low-hanging fruit of, well, what is the low-hanging fruit here? You talked about red flag laws. Is that something that everybody in Congress can get behind?
It seems like something that is the easiest thing to pass, but it's still going to be hard because the National Rifle Association, of course, is still a very strong lobby here in Washington, and they're definitely not in favor of things that restrict gun laws in any way. So it's something that is plausible could pass, and it seems kind of straightforward. But then there's people who say, well, there's not a way to really work that. So I say Joe here has a mental issue and cops come and take his guns, and Joe has no right to say, like, well, how do I challenge this? I'm actually totally fine. So you're going to get those kind of arguments against it. You would think it's a matter of fact, but it's gun law. It's never a matter of fact.
Well, and there's the sort of stigma around mental illness as well. In the wake of this shooting, the President of the United States talked about, mental illness and violent video games. A lot of people, and obviously proponents of stricter gun regulations, pointed to the fact that mental illness levels are pretty even worldwide, and a lot of countries out there have high rates of playing violent video games, but that the U.S. is all by itself when it comes to numbers of mass shootings, and they say that the point of differentiation is access to guns. Is anybody in the Utah delegation looking at restricting access to guns? I mean, you talked about the assault-style weapons ban that the House was able to pass. I don't know, Tommy.
No, the answer is no. Lost in this conversation is seemingly the conversation about guns. With the exception of McAdams, the Utah's Republicans in Congress are talking about, mental health care and video games and, trying to stop criminals rather than we talk about, the things that actually kill the people.
How about the way that the shooters are treated when we have this repeated and ongoing national conversation about mass shootings? A complaint that I've seen voiced in the lofty halls of Twitter is that if of the more than 250 mass shootings that have happened this year, if those shootings were called terrorism and tied to a scary foreign boogeyman, then there'd be a lot of action taken one way or another. That's not happening here.
I passed to George on the editorial side, but I will point out there have been 251 mass shootings in America in the 215 days after El Paso. And we really have to look at this situation and say, look at the FBI. The FBI is saying they have raised concerns about, white nationalists, white supremacy, and these groups are becoming a threat to America. That's our own FBI.
George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist and opinion, you get to offer opinions for the Salt Lake Tribune. The president says that mental illness pulled the trigger, not the gun, which is a hard statement to sort of parse, but just on the topic of gun reform in America, I don't know. This is such a broad topic, George.
Well, one, it's the guns. I mean, in Japan and South Korea, young men are absolutely ape about video games. I mean, they go into detox to get out of playing video games all the time. They don't shoot each other. We have mental illness all over the world. Some countries are better than others at treating it and recognizing it. We have it here. It's the guns. On top of that is this undercurrent fed by the internet, not created by it, but fed by it, of young white males who don't like Mexicans, can't get a date, probably do play video games too much, which doesn't mean they are made violent, but it just means that they're cut off from society and real people. And they feel alone and powerless, and so they take it out on 20 people in a Walmart who happen to look a little bit different than they do. Bill Clinton the other day was saying, look, I signed this ban on assault weapons mass shootings went way down, and then after the ban expired, they went way up. And PolitiFact checked him and said, well, you can't really say it went way down, because even before the Clinton ban on assault rifles, we didn't have
as many
mass shootings like this. So you can't really say it went down. But after the ban was lifted, it went up. It went up a lot. And it's just ridiculous to say that that's not part of it. But, it's kind of like air quality. Because there isn't one thing that you can do and one bad guy that you can blame it on, then we wind up not doing anything. Because anytime you propose something, somebody will say, well, in that case, it wouldn't have prevented it. Or over here, this guy would have passed the background check, even if you had it. You know, the prisons are full of people who were law-abiding citizens up to a point, and then they weren't anymore. And so, but, you know, it's the guns.
But, George, though, this is a right under the U.S. Constitution, gun ownership, right to keep and bear arms. Actually, as I think about it, are there other enumerated rights for specific objects? It's an interesting one to kind of contemplate on. I need to revisit the Constitution.
Well, even Justice Scalia said, yes, owning weapons is a personal right, which the court has really not really said up till that point. The first part of the clause about the well-regulated militia, you know, does that mean anything, or was James Madison just clearing his throat? I mean, you know, does membership in a well-regulated militia, well-regulated mean being like the Army, when they don't think you're trustworthy, they take your gun away from you?
Yeah.
I mean, my son's in the Army Reserve. He trains on weapons. When he goes out to the private sector gun range, they call me and say, your son wants to shoot a gun. Is he stable? And I tell him he is, and he doesn't shoot anybody, and then he gets to do it again. It's something to be concerned about. But the idea that the Second Amendment protects any weapon that anybody wants to have, I mean, the First Amendment protects free speech. It doesn't protect child pornography. It doesn't protect slander and libel. It doesn't protect shouting fire in a crowded theater. Every right has its limits and its boundaries.
Thomas Burr, guns, as George is pointing out, a hot political topic, and that is something that was evidenced by the words of a political challenger to Representative Chris Stewart this week. Chris Stewart has said, you know, offered some support of those red flag laws that you were talking about earlier. He has a potential challenger calling him out for that, right?
Yeah, so a new challenger to Chris Stewart, Mary Burkett. Don't know much about her, but she came out obviously going to Congressman Stewart's right and the right flank and saying that that we shouldn't pass laws that infringe on well-meaning and well-regulated people who own guns, that the American citizens shouldn't have more laws that restrict their weapons. It's a signal clearly that they think that he's not conservative enough, so it'll be interesting to see somebody running to his right.
One of the ways that that this candidate suggested that the support that she had for allowing guns and challenging Chris Stewart on these red flag laws was that these rights come from God. George Pyle, you're the editorial page editor, and I mean, I'll say it, people for a time had the right to own slaves, and did that right come from God? But what's your take on the challenge?
Sure, they thought it did, and they could quote you chapter and verse on why it did. We have to have, if we're going to have a society that anybody feels safe living in, you know, you go back to the Declaration of Independence, and to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, and we use the government to protect us, not just from the government, but from each other. We didn't have to be protected from each other. We wouldn't have a government. We wouldn't need one. And anybody who places other people in danger is somebody who should be looked at by the government and maybe be subject to some civil restrictions like red flag laws, which are problematic. There's always the possibility that somebody's got absolutely nothing wrong with him and his neighbor's mad at him because he let his dog loose or something and he can rat him out in some way. There's always a need for due process. And with the federal law, I'm not entirely sure how that would work. That seems to be better approached by states and state courts. But, yeah, anything can be abused. Any restriction, any regulation, any limitation can go too far, can be abused, can be trained on people who are unpopular with their family, their neighbors, or their community. That's the balancing act we always have to deal with.
Thomas Brewer.
If I can jump in for one second, it's fascinating to see, like, what it will ever take to have something done. I'm not saying what should be done. It's just, you know, massacre after massacre, and then we get to the point where, like, oh, we should do something, and nothing happens. And it's, I don't know what it will take, and I don't know. I'm posing the question maybe to George. I'm fascinated to see where we go.
I don't know who said this, but it's been picked up on Twitter over and over and over, is the idea that after Sandy Hook, this nation sat still for the slaughter of first graders, and when we wouldn't do anything after that, we're not going to do anything. And then, of course, there's the Onion headline.
No way to prevent this, says only nation where this regularly happens.
And they just trot that out all the time, and because, you know, it's like evergreen, and it's like a lot of, you know, Onion National Lampoon humor. It's kind of sick, but it works because there's so much truth to it.
Thomas, Tommy, does that feel like what you do every time there's a mass shooting in America? I mean, it's kind of wash, rinse, and repeat, you know, rinsing out blood, I guess. You go back to the congressional delegation and seek comment, and you've been doing this for a while. Does it feel really repetitive at this point?
You know, I'm going to tell you, so this week I interviewed Governor Steve Bullock, who's running for president. He's the Montana governor, and I was talking to him about this, and he wasn't joking, but it was a really kind of sad point he made. He's like, you know, when I was governor, there was a shooting, and we were going to, you know, lower the flags to half staff. And he said to his staff, we're going to need a statement. They're like, okay, we have a boilerplate for that. And it's literally like a fill-in-the-blank thing. Like, it's almost how I write these things. You know, thoughts and prayers were given to X because of something happening in X, and somebody died, and police said this, and that's literally what we're dealing with all the time.
All right. Well, I think it's also worth pointing out that your chances of being killed in a mass shooting are still infinitesimally small, but, of course, that is little comfort to people who have lost loved ones to this homegrown form of terror. And we will keep watching and watching. Right now, though, we need to head to a quick break, and there is still more to come on Behind the Headlines just ahead. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is brought to you in part by our members and Intermountain Healthcare, a not-for-profit healthcare system with 23 hospitals and 170 medical clinics located throughout the Intermountain West. Intermountain Healthcare also offers managed care under the insurance brand Select Health. Information at intermountainhealthcare.org.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, we'll take you to concert halls, clubs, and festivals around the world to catch live music by some of our favorite international stars. From Zimbabwe's Oliver Mitukudzi to Mexico's Julieta Venegas. I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join us for World Music Live, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Join us Friday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Thomas Brewer, Taylor Stevens, and George Pyle. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and we invite you to join us with your questions and comments. Again, the number 801-355-8255. You can tweet us at KCPW as well. Thomas Brewer, Salt Lake Tribune Washington correspondent, you broke some big news earlier this week. The U.S. ambassador to Russia, former Utah Governor John Huntsman Jr., is resigning from that post. Why?
He is, and I think there's a future he's looking at as well that's a little different than what we expected from somebody who has been in Moscow for a while. But Huntsman has been serving almost 2 years now as the U.S. ambassador to Russia. It's a tough job being the guy between President Trump and President Putin. And he's already said, you know, he wanted to spend about 2 years there and come home, that it's a really difficult challenge. And we can all see what a difficult challenge that is. He has about a third of the staff that his predecessors have because of all the sanctions. U.S. foreign policy is a little unclear with the president's praising of Putin all the time. What we saw was the ambassador submitting his resignation to the president and, kind of laying out the challenges that are there and how we can, have a better relationship, but saying that he wants to come home because of his growing family and other opportunities, which could include a run for governor.
Speculation on that gubernatorial run, is that a foregone conclusion or is it just speculation at this point?
It's all speculation until they file the paperwork, I guess. But at this point, it sounds like people I've talked to are close to him, or he say he's very much considering it when he was, when he thinks about the favorite jobs he's had, deputy trade rep, ambassador to Singapore, ambassador to China, ambassador to Russia. He always goes back to his favorite time, he says, according to people near him, is that it was when he was governor.
The U.S. And Russian presidents had a conversation about this departure or about who Huntsman might be replaced by. Or actually, what was said between Trump and Putin, as far as we know, Tommy?
Yeah, we don't really know much. We know that they discussed a successor, and it's going to be an interesting job and a hard job to fill. So, I mean, we all knew that Huntsman was going to leave at one point. I was the first person to get his actual resignation letter, but I think we all, it's rumored to be for a long time. The president knew, obviously Putin knows. My phone may be bugged, I don't know. Who's going to replace him is a tough one because that's a really difficult job where you have, the said U.S. foreign policy, and then you have what President Trump tweets sometimes. And the fact that President Trump and President Putin will sit down, alone and have a conversation without anyone else in the room means how does the ambassador then go to foreign policy when he doesn't know what the actual policy should be?
Hmm. Yeah, I guess I shouldn't laugh at the idea of your phone being bugged. Tough job. Oh, hold on. There you are, George. I cut you out of that. Well, make your joke again.
You just as well laugh, okay. Or you can cry.
Can we talk about how John Huntsman Jr. has been viewed by the president and by Vladimir Putin? I mean, again, as you said, Tommy, this was not an easy moment in the history of the bilateral relationship. Is that the central reason for why John Huntsman is leaving is that it's so tough to be in that job? Or, again, I guess you don't know.
Oh no, I don't think that's the issue. It's because it was a difficult job, and John Huntsman left,
right,
18 months ago. I think the actual issue is that he's like, it's an exhausting position, and I think he has aspirations, and it's a good time to come back. The idea of being in a tough spot, he kind of relishes that. He's a skilled diplomat, but at some point you can't do it anymore.
Have there been responses from the other declared candidates in the gubernatorial race here in Utah? Actually, are there more than one candidate at this moment on the idea of John Huntsman Jr.? I saw that there was some comments made from Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, who is running for governor.
Yeah, so Spencer Cox said that he welcomes Huntsman back and that if he jumps in the gubernatorial race, that he would make him a better candidate. And so he kind of welcomed that. I don't know if he, personally had a different reaction, but the idea is he's like, no, that's great. The other people will kind of see, and I can already tell you how the spin's going to be. There's going to be two arguments going forward. The ones who are not Huntsman fans are going to say, he resigned as governor, he resigned as ambassador to China, now he's resigning as ambassador to Russia, now he wants to be your governor again. And Huntsman's people are going to respond with, when your country asks you to serve, you serve. And, when the president calls, you answer the phone. And what better representative do you want than somebody who will go into a difficult situation and try to make it better?
George Pyle, on the topic of John Huntsman Jr., the once and future governor, mm-hmm. I mean, what do you make of a potential run by Ambassador Huntsman here in the state of Utah, and also, his departure from his post?
Well, I think a lot of people did look at John Huntsman as ambassador as one of the grown-ups in the room, a diminishing core of people in this administration who fit that description, and feel bad that he's leaving because you know, supposedly Trump and Putin were discussing who ought to replace him, and you worry that it's going to be somebody that Putin likes, when that isn't really his call, although I suppose diplomatic niceties would be that you don't appoint somebody who you know that the receiving country is going to hate. I mean, that's not very diplomatic. So now the informed supposition is that he's going to come home and run for governor again because he liked being governor. And because unlike a lot of these other jobs, when you're the governor, you can actually do stuff. You know, you can propose things and sometimes they happen. You can give orders and they get carried out. When you're in the legislature, when you're in Congress, when you're a diplomat, you know, you're so much at the mercy of so many other factors that it can get really old after a while. I think the fact that he was governor and left, was ambassador to here and then there and left, will be something that might count against him. Plus, you know, you really, I think, have to kind of feel sorry for Spencer Cox. He's out there, even though this was always hanging over it, you know, in his bus visiting every 237, however many there are, cities in Utah out there, and then he has this specter of John Huntsman walking back into the state and say, "Hi, remember me, I want my job back," and his name recognition and everything, it might work.
I think, aren't there just two, I don't know if anybody here can answer this, but aren't there just two declared gubernatorial candidates at this point, Spencer Cox, and then there's a businessman, Jeff Burningham. And then there's this slew of potential candidates who might show up, and they include Rob Bishop and Greg Hughes and, you know, Sean Reyes from time to time is thrown out there. Yeah. This race could...
Let's start with the fact, Roger, that it's August, and we still have a little bit of time to go.
Good point.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think there's only two, but we have plenty of time, and they don't have to declare now. People often do this exploratory thing for a while where... They toy with it because then they don't have to file any financial reports. They don't have to say they're an actual candidate. And if we're talking about, you know, Huntsman jumping in the race, the idea that he can jump in January and toss $1 million of his own money into his campaign, it's pretty simple.
Yeah, probably what he needs to do is be very careful about who he picks as his lieutenant governor, because we're all going to be looking at him as the next governor.
Yeah.
Spencer Cox is looking for a job.
Yeah. Well, he's experienced in that. He could do that.
What about Huntsman as lieutenant governor under Cox?
No.
Okay. All right. Just checking. you know, we're getting close to the end of the show here, and so I think that at this juncture, we should turn to our final segment, which is the underplayed stories of the week. And this is where we highlight stories that maybe didn't get play or that we just didn't cover on the show today. And you want to highlight, and let's go back to Taylor Stevens, who we haven't heard from in a little bit. Taylor, what is your pick for underplayed story of the week today?
Yeah, I want to highlight a story from my colleague Bethany Rogers. She wrote a story this week, and you know, there's a lot of talk about voter fraud. However, Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox said, as she was kind of following him on his gubernatorial campaign visit in Box Elder County recently, said that the voter fraud in Utah is more than kind of shadowy figures, more often overstepping moms of members of the Church of Latter-day Saints missionaries, their moms, filling out their ballots while they are out in the field abroad. So,
right, that's the vast majority of voter fraud that happens in Utah. Do you know, does that, this story struck me and I didn't read the whole thing. I'm just wondering, have very many of those moms been charged with a crime for that?
No, never, as far as we can tell. So still, you know, the same penalty, whether you're a mom or whether you are, you know, not here legally. But, yeah, that's kind of what they've identified as the more pressing issue in Utah.
And Cox pointed out that missionaries can vote from abroad online now here often.
Yeah, Utah County is also piloting a project to let them vote along with other people who are abroad. So
great pick for underplayed story. Thanks, Taylor. George Pyle, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Another Bethany Rogers story, this one about the state is going through this process of licensing people to grow marijuana that can be used in the medical marijuana regime, assuming we ever actually get that going. And what I found interesting about it was some in-state companies were protesting that they didn't get a fair shake in the licensing procedure. They lost to out-of-state companies that had experience growing marijuana, and they were saying, hey, if we had experience growing marijuana in Utah, we'd be criminals. So don't hold that against us.
Okay, and again, there was 8 licenses given out, and 10 were
Yeah, the legislation allows up to 10. They only gave 8. They said they were afraid of an oversupply. I don't know if there's such a thing. But.
I'm going to plug a KCBW show here. Our edition of In the Hive this week looked at the current state of medical marijuana in Utah and what the future holds. Check that out at kcbw.org. Great pick from George there as well. And Thomas Burr in Washington, what's your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week?
First, I'd like to make clear that I was not polled, nor have I donated to the Salt Lake mayoral race.
Okay.
So that that's just clear with everyone. So I would point to the raucous town hall that Congressman Chris Stewart faced this week, and where he was, you know, approached by people concerned about gun safety, and him standing up to President Trump, and just note that. Congressman Rob Bishop has no town halls scheduled. Senator Mike Lee, when I asked his office whether he was going to do any town halls, the response was no. Mitt Romney's going to have something apparently later this month. John Curtis has a couple scheduled. Just wanted to let people know that's the situation.
Yeah, that looked like a raucous town hall, and I'd love to see video or audio footage of that or hear.
We have some at sltrib.com, actually.
Oh, all right. All right, we'll head over there. Thank you for that pick, Thomas Burr. I'm going to go, for my part, with the governor's response, Governor Gary Herbert's response to a complaint from environmentalists about mislabeled nuclear waste coming through Utah. 9 environmental groups raised alarm after the governor of Nevada said that 32 shipments of radioactive material incorrectly labeled as low-level waste were shipped from Nevada or to Nevada from Tennessee between the years 2013 and 2018. Governor Herbert says that he has assurances from the feds that it didn't come through Utah, and a question that I have about that is, you know, should we be taking the word of the federal government if they're the ones that are mislabeling or sending this mislabeled stuff across the country in the first place? Check out that story by the Tribune's Lee Davidson, I believe, at sltrib.com, as well as all of the stories that we have been covering today. Thomas Burr, Taylor Stevens, and George Pyle, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining me on Behind the Headlines.
Thanks, Roger.
Thank you.
No problem. That wraps up this edition of Behind the Headlines, which is a production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks, as always, to our operations director, Jesse Ellis, for his help with the program, and to the team at Utah Public Radio in Logan for their help as well. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local shows at kcpw.org or through your favorite podcast app. And you can always catch up with us, KCPW, that is, on Twitter and Facebook. Just search KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for listening to Behind the Headlines. Hope you have a great weekend.
Hi, I'm Steve Williams, host of Jazz Time here on Utah Public Radio. I hope you'll join me Sunday evenings for a journey through the world of jazz music, from ragtime to bop, from Havana to Logan, Utah. Tune in for a bit of history, commentary, the occasional interview, and of course, all that jazz. Jazz Time, Sunday evenings at 6 o'clock on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, and also heard at upr.org.